Good morning. Great to see so many people here. Welcome to Zen Center, especially if this is your first time to Zen Center. Welcome. I am so glad you're here. This morning I'm going to tell a story. This is a story that's close to my heart. And it's about applying Buddhist practice in a complex and difficult world. So, November 11th was Veterans Day. And on that day, I went to a Veterans Day commemoration where I work. We get outside speakers in where I work. And on this particular day, we had a speaker named Sal Ginta, who is a Medal of Honor winner. He was awarded the Medal of Honor for saving the lives of members of his squad in Afghanistan. And he's the first living person to receive the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. He's from Iowa, and he's a humble guy. And he stressed over and over that what he did not do alone, and that it felt strange to him getting this medal alone, because everyone did it. And the crowd, there were about 300 people, stood and applauded him, gave him a standing ovation twice, and I joined in. And someone asked all the veterans present to stand, and they did, and everyone applauded them. Someone counted there were 29 people there, and I joined in, and it felt good. But it had taken me a few days prior to this event to decide whether I wanted to go. And when I did decide to go to this event, I did so deliberately. I wanted to make a kind of statement to myself, and it was kind of a big deal to me. And you could say that it was kind of a long road that brought me there. So this subject, anything involving war and the military, is a difficult subject for me. And that is because of my family's and my own really complex and difficult relationship to things military and to war. And that's what I'd like to talk about this morning. And perhaps you have a similar story. A lot of people do. So I am drawn to difficult subjects because I think there's a lot to learn in difficult places. As a Zen teacher, I am drawn to koans, which are questions, riddles, stories that can't really be resolved with the logical mind. And they may just stay unresolvable, and I just like to hold the question. I like to go to the difficult place and hold the question, because I think that there is a lot to learn there. And sometimes there's a kind of resolution, which is great, and sometimes there isn't. And when there's no resolution, I just keep holding the question. So I've actually been thinking about doing a talk on this subject for several years, quite a few years, and I knew I would someday. And finally, I came up with a hook, which was the Veterans Day ceremony. And it seemed like the time had come, but I hesitated. And I talked to my wife, Kathy, about it, and I said, you know, it's kind of a painful subject for me. It's going to be hard to talk about. It could be painful for others. People might not like it. Some people are going to think I went too far this way. Some people are going to think I went too far the other way. And it would be really bad to get this wrong, you know, to approach this talk with a spirit of reconciliation and actually make things more divided. You know, that would be really bad. So I told her all this, and she said, I think you should do the talk. And I think she was right. So I'm going to do that. And once I decided to do the talk, I had to do it. I had to write it down right away. It was like that hot iron ball we read about, that molten iron ball we read about in Zen literature, which you can neither swallow nor disgorge. We'll see if it gets disgorged or not. So, a little history here. My father, I've talked about my father before in various talks. My father graduated from high school in 1942. And his generation was defined in very large part by World War II, which was a war that virtually everyone supported. And I graduated from high school exactly 30 years later, in 1972, and my generation was defined in large part by the Vietnam War, either by people's support for it or their opposition to it. And my dad was a veteran, and he initially supported the war, like just about everyone did, the war in Vietnam. But he was also a thinking, independent person, and he came to the point where he started to believe that it was an unjust war. And no one knows how many people died in that war, but there are estimates of up to 3 million people dying in that war, mostly Vietnamese people, but some Cambodians, some Laotians, Americans, South Koreans, Australians, various nationalities. But if you go back to the time when the Vietnamese were fighting the French, 3 million people, possibly. And my father came to the conclusion that this was more about the West imposing its view on Vietnam than it was about helping the Vietnamese people or doing something that was beneficial to our country. And this was around 1969 in a small town in North Dakota, and that view was not popular, and I think my dad was the only adult I knew who had ever expressed any opposition to that war. And initially, I supported the war, too, but I changed my opinion, in large part due to my dad's influence, I think, but I think he was right. And by the fall of 1969, I was in the 10th grade, and I wanted to express my opinion. And it happened that there was a group that called for a national moratorium against the war. This was October 15th, 1969. It was a nationwide demonstration and teach-in. So I got together with a friend who felt the way I did, and we went to a fabric store, and we bought a lot of black cloth. And we took it home, and we cut it into strips. I'm reminded of a later sewing project. and I like the parallel. But what we did with these strips of black cloth is we took them to school and we distributed them so people could make black armbands. And out of 500 kids in the high school, we probably got, I shouldn't say we got, 30 or 40 people probably chose to wear these armbands in protest of the war. And I think the administration kind of freaked out. Nobody had ever seen anything like this before. But nothing really, you know, bad happened to us as a result. It was a protest. And I'm glad I did it. The next summer, 1970, my family, along with me, moved to another state, to an even smaller town. And during that summer, I grew my hair long. And I showed up at my new school with long hair, and I was really vocal in my opposition to the war. And I don't know if I ever thought about, you know, is this going to make things easy for you, Ted, or not? I don't know if I thought about that, but that's what I did. And it wasn't a popular position. And I'll give you an example of how it wasn't a popular position. In November of 1970, there was that horrible incident where William Calley, he was an American second lieutenant, he was tried for the murder of 22 unarmed Vietnamese civilians. This was the My Lai massacre. And my social studies teacher just made that the topic of conversation all day. And at the end of the day, I think I was in the last period or second to the last period, I raised my hand and I said, well, I think he should be tried. I think this was murder. And he said I was the only person all day that expressed that opinion. Everybody else thought he was a scapegoat or war is so confusing you cannot tell the difference between who's the enemy or not. And I thought, well, these were, you know, a lot of these were children. These are women and children. So many of you were not born yet when all of this happened and probably don't know too much about it. You've probably heard some things about it, but really I think you cannot imagine how divided this country was about that war. Those of you who are my age, I think you remember. It was rough. One of the archetypal images was when a bunch of construction workers in hard hats attacked a lot of demonstrators and were beating them up. Another was the in the streets of Chicago during the 1968 Democratic Convention, the police battling protesters. A lot of rough stuff happened. There were assassinations. It's like we became two societies. It was like there was no middle ground. If you dropped out, you really dropped out, and you found your own people with a self-separate culture for kind of self-protection. It's like you joined a new tribe. And among guys, long hair was a visible symbol of this. And if you saw another guy with long hair, it meant, oh, okay, you know, we're kind of part of the same tribe. But for a lot of people, it engendered hatred, just seeing the hair. It's not like now. And that was the situation for me in this new town. It was kind of rough. I mean, I don't mean to overstate it. And I don't want to sound like a victim here, but I just kind of need to tell you the facts. I got threatened with physical violence, you know, every day in high school, probably 5 to 10 times a day, at least during my junior year. It got a little better during my senior year. And it was like a daily ritual for these guys. And usually it was, we're going to cut that hair. But sometimes it was worse, you know, worse threats. I was forbidden to go to one of my best friend's houses. Her dad told me that if I ever came to his house again, he would throw me out the door, and he would not open the door. At least he had a sense of humor. I thought that was a good line. The principal called me into his office, and he told me to cut my hair. And I told him, if you force me to cut my hair, or try to, I'm going to contact the American Civil Liberties Union, and they will sue the school district, because they had said they would do this. And so he backed off. And moving forward, when I graduated, I still had long hair. I would have people follow me when I was out driving. One day when I was walking, I had someone pull up beside me in a car, and this guy leaned out and he just tried to punch me, and he missed me by about this much. And they drove away and they were laughing. You know, these guys were always laughing. And out of everything that happened, I think that was the worst. Their, you know, constant laughter at their own cruelty. That was hard. And so one time there was this big group of guys. It was all guys, maybe 15 or so, and they grabbed me in school during lunch hour, and one of them had a scissors, you know. And I don't know if something spooked them or what, but they only cut one lock. Maybe when it actually came down to it, they lost their nerve. I don't know what happened there. And they would attack me in phys ed, you know. And I was told I was quite a topic of conversation among the adults down at the Legion Club, which was the local branch of a veterans organization. So I had this sense of kind of being hated by an entire town. I had some friends, but there was a lot of hatred there. And I had to be really careful about where I went, you know. I couldn't go to football games or school dances or things like that. You know, in the daytime I could go downtown, but didn't want to do that in the evening. You know, but that was okay. I had a small group of really close friends, you know, and they got me through. And I am grateful to those people and to this day and love them very much. And occasionally get together with them and we talk about this stuff. So my older brother, who he also had long hair, he supported me in all this. He got a high lottery number and was not drafted. And by the time I turned 18, the draft had ended. So I didn't get drafted. I went off. I left that town. And eventually the war ended. So that was over 40 years ago. And I got to tell you, despite all of my Zen training, despite all of my talking about letting go, it still hurts a little bit. And I think I still carry some of that pain in my body. I find it now and then. And I work on releasing it. And I think I can do that. I think I can let it go completely yet. But it's good to still have things to work on, right? It wouldn't be very interesting if I didn't. So what I experienced, I got to make this point, was nothing compared to what was experienced by people who actually went to the war and suffered through that and were wounded, and people who were killed, or what was suffered by people who went to prison because they opposed the draft. I mean, what I went through was nothing compared to that. But still, to me, it was something. So there was that. But that is less than half the story. There's also this. There's this strong military tradition in my family. There were no career soldiers that I know of, except one, whom I'll talk about in a little bit. But there were lots of people who went to war. On my dad's side, we've traced this back. There were guys who fought in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. On my mom's side, there was a guy who lost his leg in the Civil War, supposedly at Gettysburg. I've seen a picture of him sitting on his porch with a crutch on one side and a fiddle on the other. My grandpa Toole lied about his age and went into the Army, I think at the age of 17 during World War I, and he was stationed at Fort Des Moines. He never fought. My other grandpa, my grandpa Carpenter, was sent to France, and he would tell stories about how they fed him goat meat on the ship going across, and how when he got there just when the war ended, and he told about being in a trench with an Englishman having tea, but he didn't have to fight. And my dad, as I said, graduated in 42, and he immediately joined up, of course. And he spent most of the war in Texas and Virginia, and he got shipped out to Europe in about 1945. So he was lucky, like my grandpa Carpenter, he got to Germany right about the time the war ended, and he said he just pulled a whole lot of guard duty. And he had this box of souvenirs from the Army, and he'd get it out about once or twice a year and show it to my brothers and me. And we loved that. And we would look at every precious object with admiration and great interest. He had the insignia from his uniform and a lot of photographs and a really large bullet and a Nazi armband that he had gotten somewhere in Germany. And this little booklet that I still have on how to speak a little German, which he used to teach me some German. But he always told us that he hated the Army, and he would never let us call him Sir because it reminded him of the Army. But we romanticized his Army service. We were kids. That's how kids are. And that was our culture at the time. When I was a kid, it seemed like almost every adult male I knew had been in World War I or World War II. And so many of the movies and TV shows we watched were about the war, and it kind of got into our bones. And we were always playing at war. You know, we fought the Japanese and Germans. That's what we played. And we liberated every corner of our farm again and again. And then, this is a big part of the story, there's my younger brother, John. He was born 11 years after me, and I love him dearly. And I kind of tried to make him into a leftist radical. I did. I no longer try to make anyone into anything, but back then I think I did. But he did not want to be a radical. He was always drawn to the military tradition in our family, to the point where he wanted to enlist in the Army. He could have done just about anything, but that was his dream, to be in the Army. This was long after the Vietnam War had ended, and it was peacetime, but it still made me uncomfortable. And I wanted to say, what is this? You know, you want to join the military? What if they require you to do something that is morally wrong? This is what I'm thinking. You know, our country has a history of overthrowing democratically elected leaders, sometimes with the military, sometimes without. There was Guatemala in 1954, there was Iran in 1953, and the repercussions of that are still being felt in a massive way. You know, what if they try to require you to do something that you don't believe in? And we didn't argue about it, really. And in fact, I don't think I ever said all of this stuff to him. I said some of this stuff to him once. We just didn't talk about it. We talked, and we still loved each other, but we didn't talk about that. So it was kind of an uncomfortable few years there. But he knew what was right for him, and he enlisted in the Army, and he served for, I don't know, maybe it was 12 years or something like that, and he became a sergeant. He was a paratrooper. He did 80 jumps, and as a result of his service, he became completely disabled. He did so many jumps from airplanes that he would hit hard, you know, and his back actually compressed, and he lost an inch or two in height. His back and knees are bad, and he walks with a cane, and what I'm describing is only part of what he did and part of what he suffered as a result of what he gave to his country. So that's my little brother. We've become closer as we've gotten older, really. I officiated at his wedding, which was great. I've begun to talk to him about how much he gave for his country and to thank him for his service. And I do that a lot, actually. I mention that a lot. And at first it surprised him. And now he's getting used to it, and it feels good. And so I really wanted to go to this Veterans Day thing this year. So it is a complex world, and I have tried to do what is right. And I am proud of how I stood up to all those people in that town. I never gave in. And that was probably the most difficult thing I ever did when I was 16 and 17 and 18. I think I did what was right. But I didn't always get everything right. And here's where I think I went wrong. It was when I would do things like when I was saying to my little brother, what if they send you somewhere and they ask you to do something that is wrong? The implication in that question is that there's a risk that this could happen, that they could send you to do something that was wrong, and you have to weigh that against, you know, whether you should go at all. The thing is that this was based on my mental list of what we've done as a nation that is wrong and what we have done that is right. Although I'm a Buddhist, I'm not a pacifist. Some Buddhists are pacifists, and I completely respect their point of view, but I think that sometimes protecting life, protecting the innocent, unfortunately requires force, and I think of Hitler and the concentration camps as the strongest proof of that. So I've got my own mental list of what we've done as a country that's right and what's wrong. World War II, I think, was justified. Iraq, I think, no. The Spanish-American War, no, etc. I have this rather detailed list. But the point is, this is my list. This is not John's list, or your list, anyone else's list. I'm just one person with an opinion about some very complex matters. You know, and there are some things here at Zen Center that perhaps I can speak with a little authority on, like meditation or the Six Realms or the Eightfold Path, because I've been doing this a long time and I have some training. When it comes to my ideas about whether military actions are moral, I'm just one guy. And how can I say that my list should be someone else's list? When my brother made his calculation of whether the good from his service would outweigh the danger of something bad, how can I judge that? How can I say he's wrong because his calculation might be different from mine? Well, I don't think I can. And I think the older I get, the more I know that that is true. I think it's a natural thing to get less secure in your fixed views as you get older. Now, I know some people go the other way, but I think there's a lot of wisdom in being less sure. And we talk about that all the time here, about not being so quick to know, about always being open, about always asking. So people went wrong all those years ago on both sides. It was completely wrong for people, I think, to deny others their freedom of speech through threats, and particularly to do this in the name of freedom. But there was a place where my generation, at least that part of my generation that opposed the war, also went wrong. And this is reflected in the tension between me and my brother. That was when, because they opposed the war, they opposed the people who went to war. And so cruel things were said to Vietnam veterans, and they were never properly welcomed back. And I did not engage in this in any direct or egregious way, but I'm sure I contributed to it through my silence. My silence in not discussing this subject with my brother was the same silence that occurred when I failed to address this question or think about this question. What about the veterans? Are we being fair to them? My generation was wrong about that. I was wrong about that, and I am sorry. Things have changed a lot since then. The left, those who tend to oppose the war, have learned that you can oppose a war and believe it's wrong and still respect those who have a different view and choose to participate in that war. And you can see and respect that what they are doing from their point of view is laying their lives on the line to protect us. And you can respect that, and you can be grateful for that, and thank them for that. Even if your list is different from theirs, you see what they're giving. And it used to be that it seemed like the right had a total monopoly on supporting the troops, and I think that has really changed. I think the right loves to talk about supporting the troops, but when it comes to providing money for veterans and their families, for support and healing, they're not so good at that. And the left, I would like to think, is taking the lead in that. It took my brother forever to get his disability benefits, and it caused him great hardship. And that was a travesty after all that he gave for his country. How can we allow something like that to happen? So I thought a lot about Thich Nhat Hanh when I was preparing this talk. Thich Nhat Hanh, he is, by the way, very ill. He is, I think, 88 years old, and he's having great difficulty. He's a Zen Buddhist monk who came from Vietnam, and he was there during the war when it was raging, and he did not choose sides. Instead, he did his best to alleviate suffering from the war. And he had this network of people that would go out to villages to try to help. And both sides suspected him because he wouldn't choose sides, and he became an exile. He had to leave for France. It was no longer safe for him to be in Vietnam. And he always said that if a person oppresses another person, it's because of the oppressor's suffering and the oppressor's fear. And it's hard to see that. It's hard to look at someone who's oppressing another person and identify with their pain and suffering. But you have to do that if you're going to see clearly. You have to do that. You have to see that. And I've sometimes wondered, what if I could go back and do this stuff? I guess it's not too late, but what if I could go back and do this peace activism, social justice activism that I've done before, in more of a spirit of reconciliation and less in a spirit of drawing lines between good and bad, between us and them, what would happen then? I think it would be quite different. You have to be the peace. You have to be the peace if you want peace to happen. So the Buddhist way of being is focused on seeing. Seeing the world in all of its complexity, without the filter of our wants and our desires, seeing how all is interrelated, seeing how there is separation, no separation, between us and others. So there's no separation between me and a soldier actively engaged in combat. No separation between me and the draft resistors who went to prison. Between me and my friend who did 6 months at Leavenworth Camp for resisting war. Between me and the Vietnamese Buddhist monks who poured gasoline over themselves and burned to death in an effort to end the war. Between me and the Viet Cong, me and the South Vietnamese Army, me and Lieutenant Calley, me and George W. Bush, who told us all of those lies to get us into a war. Me and Lyndon Johnson, who got us into that war deeper and deeper until over 50,000 Americans died. There's no separation between grown-up anti-war Ted and the child Ted who played at war. There's no separation between war and anti-war. And what about all those high school kids who used to chase me around? Well, there's no separation there. I didn't see all that much suffering on their part or so much fear, but I think it was there. I think actually they were encouraged a lot by adults. And those adults were afraid. They were afraid of losing their way of life. They saw the war. They saw riots and domestic violence and domestic as in violence in this country. And they were fearful of losing their way of life. And those kids, they shouldn't have been so mean, but hey, I've made mistakes too. I could have been a little less provocative. You know, if you're trying to convince somebody of something, it's good to kind of start where they are and say, well, what are they thinking? What's going to appeal to them? I really kind of didn't do that. I'll be outrageous and see what happens. So my grandpa Toole, at his funeral, there was a flag on his coffin, and the Legionnaires were there, and they fired off their rifles. And at my grandpa Carpenter's funeral, the same thing happened. He was 101 years old. He was the last World War I vet in an area of about 6 counties or so. And I was glad they were there. I was glad they were there. And then at my dad's funeral, they were there again, and they fired their rifles, and I had softened a lot by this time. They were there to honor my dad. And it's not just I was glad they was there. It's like, I love these guys, you know. I mean, maybe I don't know them, but I know people from their families. We're all from this same town, you know, generations, everybody marrying each other and everything. Some of them, they may have served with my dad. I love these guys. This is an old cemetery. My great-grandparents are in there. My grandparents are in there. Now my parents are in there. And there are a lot of those other families are in there, too. So people had come to this town like a century earlier to settle, and they all lived together, and they married each other, and they worked things out for decades and decades, and wars came, and they went, and wars ended, and they came back, and some didn't come back. And here in death, they're all together. They're all together in the ground, you know. My family, their family. And there's really no separation there. So, and there's this little bizarre postscript. So once I was at the Legion Club, you can't boycott the Legion Club because a lot of things happen there. People go there after funerals, you know, and it's just... So I started going to the Legion Club. And it was after one of these funerals. It could have been my dad's, actually, in the 1990s, or maybe it was one of my grandfather's. But I wanted to thank one of these Legionnaires, so I did. I went up and I introduced myself, and I shook my hand, and he said his name. And we both instantly realized at the same time that it was that guy who had said he would throw me out the door without opening the door. And here's the funny thing. He had long hair. He had long white hair. And I had short hair. But so, and then what did I do? I bought a pickup truck and I became a construction worker. I started looking just like those guys. You know, so probably with this guy's long hair, it's just that long hair had kind of lost its meaning. It wasn't a political statement anymore, but maybe not. Maybe some of it was kind of a recognition on his part that things were a little not just what he thought, you know, that things are maybe not so well-defined, and it's kind of good to go a little bit the other way. And I got a few indications over the years of reconciliation. And there was one kid who's probably the worst kid of all in high school, really, really difficult kid for me. When I graduated, he came up to me and shook my hand and said, "Good luck, Ted." And I couldn't believe it, you know. And I think that was probably not easy for him to do, and I was always really happy about that. And I wonder, this was an intelligent kid, you know, and if things had been just a little bit different, we might have been best friends, this guy. So maybe there's a little part in these folks. They suspected they could have been wrong at the war, about the war, just like there's a part of me that says, hey, maybe I should have gone. Maybe I should have done my part. I mean, that's not really logical, given my belief that the war was wrong, but that part is real, and it's deeply ingrained. It's there, and you have to admit it. It's the thing that drove everyone so strongly to support those wars. I'm going, because these are my people. That's it. I'm going. I'm not going to ask any questions. I see that. I get that. So no one has a monopoly on truth. Still, we have our beliefs, and we have to do our best to conduct ourselves morally in this world. And a very basic principle of Buddhism, part of the Eightfold Path, is right action. We see the world in all of its complexity, and we go to the difficult places because we have to see in order to act. So I will continue to oppose wars that I feel are unjust. And I will continue to thank veterans for their service and support better treatment for veterans and their families. And I think that's essential for our society to be complete and whole. And as for the veterans in our Sangha, we need them here in order for this Sangha to be complete. And I hope that we as a Sangha can continue to seek healing and softening and moving toward the painful and difficult thing just as long as we can. Thank you. So, are there any comments? Yes, Gary.
Thank you for giving me some insight. I think I might have to talk about this some years from now myself. But one of the things I remember, I got involved early on, even before my Unitarian friends and parents were against the war. And I used to go to the state college.
Can you folks hear?
I go to the state college when I was 14 and joined a group called Vietnam Summer, and I went every week at outstanding attendance, but everybody was a Catholic nun or a college professor. We didn't have hippies yet.
Right. That was very early.
And we would have candlelight visuals on the courthouse steps, and there would be 20, 30 of us show up with candlelight in the middle of winter nights protesting the war. When finally this whole thing kind of hit the press, I remember remember feeling heartbroken when Chicago, you mentioned, happened.
Mm-hmm.
And people were throwing stones at the police and getting billy clubbed by the police, vice versa. And finding out that these people had incited that then went on to be prominent names in the press, and they were the leaders of the anti-war movement. I was a member of the peace movement, but when there was an anti-war movement, I guess it's probably led me to Buddhism. And maybe it's kind of similar with you. I thought we have an unjust situation, and now we have other people saying, well, that gives me the right to be unjust in return. And, you know, then all of a sudden everybody's mad, and everybody's violent, and everybody's...
And right, it was right.
So disheartening. I felt like I was in no person's land. And I thought, what am I going to do with my life? I mean, I can't... Now I don't even have a side I can stand on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of my best friends were in non-veterans for peace, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that would eventually start to tear down the universities and stuff, it just broke my heart.
Right.
And Buddhism for me meant peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm not anti-war. I'm pro-peace.
Yeah, Bob Dylan said it, good and bad, I defined those terms quite clear, no doubt, somehow. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. That's true. I saw that a lot, becoming really, really angry and mean in the in order to oppose anger and meanness. That doesn't work. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Yes, Leo.
I'm a veteran. I'd like to say that's the most best time to talk I've heard here. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Leo. Yeah.
Hippie.
Redneck. All right. Carrie.
You spoke of coming in contact with one of the, you know, people who was cruel to you.
Yeah.
You know, in later life, had you had the opportunity, since it was a high school, to go back to a high school reunion and encounter more of those boys that were, you know, very cruel to you, and find that compassion for them, like you said, the people that tend to be mean and cruel are those people that are suffering the most and are fearful.
Yeah, I did. I went to, I think it was my 35th reunion, and I was surprised because I had all this stuff I wanted to talk about, and no one wanted to talk about it. And I felt no one mentioned this stuff, at least initially. It seemed like people didn't really notice I was there, you know. Gee, I thought I'd be a big deal at this reunion. But I wasn't. But one of my really dear friends did kind of bring it up because she thought, you know, we should acknowledge the truth. This was the most divided class in the history of that town, I'm sure. I mean, when we had our senior dinner, we had two senior dinners because we were divided into two camps. And I was a little disappointed that people didn't want to talk about it. But, you know, it's a lot easier 35 years later kind of seeing everybody as people just like you. Everybody just, they just wanted to talk about their kids, you know. So so that was nice to feel like, you know, we're just kind of in this together. So thanks. Good question. Okay. Is that it?
Just one thing.
Yes.
I think we're around the same age, and our fathers are the same age.
So
probably some of the guys in this room. I'm saying how complex it is, because my role would have been like yours, but I did it with no risk. So my little town was very liberal. Everybody was against the war. I was the son of a very liberal Methodist minister, and good friends with the local draft board counselor. You know, what they call these guys? These guys would help you with your... I was a conscientious objector.
Right. These guys draft counselors, I think they called them.
Interview and fill that paperwork out. But I was doing this all with very little risk. Nobody, you know, I was the war. I had my hair long because everybody else did. I didn't have to set that, you know, set that precedent.
Right.
I visited my Nebraska cousins out in these small towns. That was a great risk. because of my hair.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
But it's just that, so I had a similar experience on the one hand, but it was at no personal risk to me.
Yeah.
I never had to put myself out there. And so I'm reminded how it can look the same and not be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And when my dad was like 18, he ran right down to, he wanted to enlist. This is before he went the conscience subjective route. He wanted to enlist to be a medic.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to be a non-combatant medic.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, we're not going to let you do that because you'll be the first picked off. So they basically said, no, we're not going to do that. So by the time I was a conscience subject, it was a very easy thing to do. And there were a lot of people in my hometown. So in other words, I can't even say it's a similar experience. I had a similar stance, but at no personal risk.
Right. Yeah.
It just makes me think, you know, I also had that feeling maybe I should have gone.
So that, yeah.
Maybe I should have gone.
Yeah.
You raise a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I'm still kind of unresolved about where I was in all that.
Yeah.
I can't claim that I knew what I was doing. I was just kind of going along with the wave that was happening around me.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.